And it was my first fix in the Kennedy's office. I was insecure in my abilities in that job. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be revealed. I'm going to be exposed as someone who can't do this. And someone calls up and they can't print. I go over to our newfangled laser printer, laser in quotes, and pop it open and pull out this piece of paper, close the printer, to test a page, and it works.
So you cleared a paper jam.
I cleared a paper jam, and I kept that Hallelujah. Piece of paper pinned to my cushion. It was like, that was my reminder. It's like, I can do this. I got this.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Chris Casey was one of the pioneers in the intersection of the internet and politics. Working for Ted Kennedy's official Senate office, he was in charge of many firsts in that area, including the first official website in Congress. In the mid-1990s, he wrote a book called The Hill on the Net about that subject. Chris then built a bunch of the early campaign websites for statewide races and notable politicians like Hillary Clinton and Ted Kennedy through his own company, Casey Doran Productions. And he later started the website practice at my company, NGP Software, later NGP Van. And Chris has had a series of interesting jobs since then, giving him many different lenses on the intersection of technology and politics. He's currently at work on a startup called To Someone. As you will see from his interview, Chris has plenty of stories to tell, and what I can say about him, having worked with him for a number of years, is that there isn't a nicer guy in the business. So, after a quick word from our sponsor, my conversation about politics and the internet through the eyes of one of its earliest adopters.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from Timeplots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. Timeplots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Hi, Chris.
Hey, Nathaniel. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Would you mind introducing yourself, giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Chris Casey.
And well done, Chris.
Thank you. I'm originally from Southern California, the original surf city, Huntington Beach. I've come to the D.C. area the same month that I graduated college and got married in August of 87, ready to wave around my bachelor's degree in political science and my very rudimentary Russian language skills.
Does that mean you met your wife in college?
We met on a college tour, a summer-long trip to Europe. So she was from Central Illinois. We just happened to be on the same 62-day, 21-country summer of 85 in Europe. It's a pretty good first date.
It sounds amazing, actually. And now you're several kids down the road and a lifetime, really, together.
This year, we'll celebrate our 32nd anniversary. We have three wonderful children, all of them now out of college and launched into their lives.
How did you first enter the world of politics and technology?
It was an interesting accident. I had no formal background or training in computers or technology. Like I said, I was a political science major, studied Russian, studied comparative communist systems, and my concern coming to D.C. was the Cold War and nukes. And much to my disappointment and surprise, it was the English language portion of the Foreign Service exam that I failed. So my career as a diplomat was very short. My wife had the only real job. She became a high school teacher in Manassas Park, Virginia. I went to my Republican congressman and got an internship. But from there, had a series of jobs that more than once kind of accidentally had some technology background. One of the first one, it was very interesting because it really introduced me to Washington information in a pre-internet stage. The company was called the Washington Service Bureau, and they were effectively a team of researchers here in D.C. whose clients were lawyers and interest groups and people scattered all over the country who didn't have a presence themselves in D.C. but needed to get their hands on that amicus brief filed at the Supreme Court or that filing from FERC or some witness testimony in Congress.
It's almost impossible, I think, for your 20-somethings now to understand how very different the world was back then.
Their main business was like FERC and energy rulings and stuff. But I worked in the side branch of the department that was called HAR, Hill and Regulatory, which basically meant Congress, the Supreme Court, and any federal agency.
But no internet.
No internet.
Information often on paper and requiring a lot of extra work to move from one place to another.
I wrote a lot of FOIA requests, and it's been a lot of time. My day was bouncing around D.C., going from one public reference room to another.
What was your first sort of more overtly political work?
Well, after a short time, I got picked up by a company at the other end of the hallway from the Washington Service Bureau, and it was a public affairs firm called the Hannaford Company. And at the Hannaford Company, Mr. Hannaford, Peter Hannaford, was a former advisor to President Reagan, his previous business partner. It used to be Deaver and Hannaford. So they were big deals in Republican public affairs.
I know you as a Democrat of long standing. Was that comfortable for you in those days?
It was, because of the fact that it was not a political firm. I mean, they were certainly took advantage of, you know, his connections and network. You know, there were other Democrats in the firm, just as there were Republicans. I was this junior account coordinator, but at the same time was excited about the fact that the job required me to become a registered foreign agent, because our clients were, you know, the Republic of China and Taiwan and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. But in that office, they had Macs, a small network of Macs. And it wasn't an official.
So that has to be very early Macs, right?
Oh, yeah.
Are we talking about?
Like the classics, you know, the 128K and then the Fat Mac. You know, you remember those, the all-in-one original iconic Macintosh design. Yeah. Though it had nothing to do with my official duty, I've been a Mac since the first. My mother brought home.
You've been a Mac?
I've been a Mac user since the first 128K version.
I well precede you having had an Apple II Plus.
I had never not on that side. I had taken a class once with some programming with an Apple II, but no, I was Mac from the beginning. I had pulled all-nighters myself, rekeying code in Macworld magazine to make my own submarine game.
You were not put off by computers. You rather were attracted to them and a kind of power user.
In a user mode, not in a programmer mode, but curious, very curious.
Yep. What did you take from that job?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, for example, one of our clients was the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and we spent more than a year bringing this cultural exhibition around the country. And so I was charged with taking a Saudi folkloric dance troupe to children's hospitals in Disneyland and various venues in each of the cities that we visited.
It's funny what one ends up doing sometimes with jobs that you would not predict.
It really, really was. Anyway, that was the first time like doing any traveling with business. It was an interesting experience in a list building because, again, pre-internet, you know, the people who came and visited this large cultural exhibition, which was just a glossy brochure for Saudi Arabia, left filling out a card saying, yes, keep me up to date. I'd like more information. So they built a mailing list. And the last stop of the exhibition ended up being just a couple months prior to Saddam Hussein invading Kuwait. The use of the mailing list that got this very polished package from Saudi Arabia explaining the backstory of the first Gulf War.
So how did you land on the Hill?
Having that rudimentary background in having built some local Mac networks and stuff, I was very interested in working in Congress. And in fact, I had visited D.C. just once before with my mother on a business trip that she was on, and I was enthralled My wife, who had studied to be a teacher, is quite obvious what you do under graduation. You go get a job as a teacher. Graduating as a newly minted political scientist left me a little bit more confused. And when the Foreign Service notion fell through, the idea of working in Congress appealed to me. And I responded to an ad. I think it was like a Democratic study group had a regular jobs listing each week. And I responded to an ad that said, Senate Democrat, all Macintosh office needs a systems administrator. And to my great fortune, that turned out to be Senator Kennedy's office. He was one of just a few all Mac offices in the Senate at the time. And somehow I convinced him I could do the job.
And that's a kind of an amazing post, as it turned out to be, for someone at the intersection of tech and politics.
And it led directly to kind of my accidental career. My wife and I are empty nesting, so there's juggling going around in the house as my basement is moving upstairs into what was my daughter's bedroom. And so I was going through a briefcase of just memorabilia, things you've kept from previous office desk. And I pulled out a scrap of paper. It's about 3 each long, like the piece of paper torn off the edge of a printer and filled with a bunch of pinholes in it. And it took me just a moment to recall what it was. And it was my first fix in the Kennedy's office. I was insecure in my abilities in that job. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm going to be revealed. I'm going to be exposed as someone who can't do this. And someone calls up and they can't print. I go over to our newfangled laser printer, laser in quotes, and pop it open and pull out this piece of paper, close the printer, to test a page, and it works.
So you cleared a paper jam.
I cleared a paper jam, and I kept that piece of paper pinned to my cushion. It was like, that was my reminder. It's like, I can do this. I got this.
Wow, that's a high bar you cleared there.
Well, what I learned, too, was as a systems administrator, it's all about the fire drill, right? It's about someone can't print, their computer's not working, it's frozen.
You have to save people.
They're in a panic moment, yeah. Right? And I've equated it to being like a fireman. You know, when there's not a fire and you're sitting around the firehouse, well, what are you doing? I was using the modem I bought for the office and dialing out to bulletin board systems.
And finding out how to solve things that way?
Well, for a little bit, just for my own curiosity, yeah. And to justify...
You couldn't just Google the answer back then.
No. To justify the fact that I was using the public's dime on this modem, I was dialing Massachusetts bulletin boards. I was on the Boston Computer Society's BBS, or the Boston Macintosh User Group. And for me, my light bulb moment was that in the time I was spending in these bulletin board systems, people are talking about a lot more than just technology. They were talking about fitness. They were talking about gardening and cooking. And they were talking about politics. And I sat in a windowless mailroom in the Russell Senate office building, surrounded by people whose job it was to churn out press releases and the constant effort any member of Congress makes to reach the media via a press release. And here was this audience of constituents. It took a few memos for me to propose and say, you know, can I just take these press releases we've already got and post them online? And that was the germination of my career.
So really. You're saying it took a few memos. That means you tried a few times and it fell on deaf ears for a minute?
Or? It was that... It was new enough, and I was young enough in my job that I really wasn't going to go out on a limb doing something dramatic without permission.
Yeah.
And yet, at the time, there was no computer on the senator's desk, not on the chief of staff's desk, not on the press secretary's desk. Email was something used entirely from desktop to desktop within the office. We could barely email another Senate office, couldn't email the House. And the notion of email from the public would have made anybody's head explode. So just conveying the notion of we can phone into computers in Massachusetts and put electronic versions of the senator's press releases there. Is that okay? Can I do it?
It's a little different than the constant tweeting by the politicians of today, right?
Well, and in fact, what was wonderful about it was, again, as the sysadmin, I wasn't getting a lot of FaceTime with the senator. You know, I had met him at one new staffer meet and greet, and that was it. But universally, as our efforts got noted.
Because you were among the first to be doing this sort of thing, if not the first.
Right? Oh, yeah, on the Hill, for sure. And Senator Kennedy started reaping a lot of praise for it. I mean, this is a time when people were not laughing when they called it the information superhighway. And, you know, there was a lot of excitement about being online.
So just doing, like, everything was a first, mm-hmm. right?
So the fact that you were making the effort for a member of Congress was notable. And, I mean, I've got a very large binder clip book of all the press Senator Kennedy got. The second time I met him, his secretary buzzed me and was like, Chris, the senator would like to speak with you. So I go into his office, and it was the day that there was a Boston Globe story on page 3 that said Senator Kennedy may be 61 years old, but he's ahead of the curve when it comes to politics. Here's the Usenet news groups where you'll find his postings. Here's his Gopher server, you know.
Which was all you.
The FTP archive. Actually, a lot of the credit I've got to give to MIT. We had very good fortune about the quality of the help in our home state. What happened there was, I was originally reaching this network of dial-up bulletin board systems. And with the first Clinton-Gore White House, and that was the first whitehouse.gov, I reached out to and connected with the people who were bringing the first White House online. And that was a guy named Jock Gill and Jeff Eller. And when I contacted them, talk about, I'd like to learn more about what you're doing at getting online. And I showed them what we had done in Kennedy's office with the bulletin boards. They introduced me to the graduate students at MIT who had helped them throughout the campaign, and now we're helping launch.
Do you remember any of those graduate students?
Oh yeah, John Mallory and Eric Loeb in particular.
Yeah, I think I've met both of them over the years.
And sure,
I know Eric fairly well.
It was amazing. I think I probably got on a phone call. I don't remember if it was John or Eric, that original call, and was telling them, you know, oh, Jock Gill said I should call you. Here's what we're doing with Kennedy on bulletin boards. And one of them, you know, why aren't you on the internet? I was like, I sit at a desk in the Senate. There is no internet here. It was only because of help from them that they created scripts so that I could post a press release once, and then they would spray it out to a couple different news groups and put it in an FTP archive. So they automated my original posting capabilities.
That's pretty cool. Talk about some of the other highlights. You spent quite a number of years with Kennedy and with the Democratic leadership on the Hill, right?
Yeah.
What are some of the other highlights of your time doing that?
Well, it's interesting to me the notion of some of the things that, like you said, everything was a first. We did a petition in Kennedy's office, and he wanted to hear from college students about what the impacts would be if their college grants, if their Pell grants were at risk, as they were perpetually were. We set up an email address in Kennedy's office and invited nationwide anybody to email us your stories, and the senator will share these. And so I'll never forget the day he was going to be making his speech. And the aide who was with him was like, all right, where's this petition? And I handed him a little floppy disk. He's like, what is this? And I said, they're all there. All the messages are on that disk. He's like, what's he going to do? Wave it around? He's like, I need a pile of paper. We need to visually convey. But we had 1,500 stories all entered in the congressional record, all collected 1,500 stories from all 50 states. Gathered via email from people talking about what would happen to them if their college grants didn't come through. I mean, I love that because, again, the notion of petitioning government, right? That's rule number one in the book.
It's protected in the Constitution, that ability, right?
It's amendment number one, yeah. And petition the government for a redress of grievances. That's how it works. That's your job there. To be there at the time when a new means of petitioning exists, and whether that means an email or sign my online petition or whatever it means now, it's exciting to see.
It is. Did you have enough interaction with the senator to draw opinions about him as a person,
as a
politician?
Very much. Well, after that first pat on the back meeting about the positive press, he gave me pretty much a like, whatever you're doing, keep doing it.
Yeah.
And I always reflect on the fact that wasn't by any means a given. I mean, he had been a member of the Senate longer than I had been alive. And at the high end of the staff, it wasn't widely used with computers yet. So there's every reason to expect that I might have hit a brick wall of like, that's not how we do things here, son. You know, just disinterest. He was super quick to grasp, if you can reach my constituents in Massachusetts with a computer, do it. Go ahead. And in fact, my comfort in taking that latitude and running it was such that when the World Wide Web came around, and the same MIT students who had first helped me get into Usenet in an FTP archive built a web page for us. Now, keep in mind, Senate.gov doesn't exist yet. Our website was at www.ai.mit.edu/iiip/.
Don't try going to this, folks.
I know, right?
And that website was that the first of any member of Congress?
Any member of Congress, yeah. Right?
And what year is that?
That was launched in 94.
Right.
And
by the way, I'm in grad school at MIT in that year.
Well, you probably saw the work then.
I heard about a project. I think it was Mallory, about trying to use AI to help answer emails coming into the White House. I don't know how well that did, but they were working on something like that at the Media Lab or related to
and that. And it might have been connected to that IIIP in the URL was their Intelligent Information Infrastructure Project. And so it was part of a broader effort there. It had originally been born during the campaign where they offered similar services to every one of the presidential candidates. And it just happened to be the Clinton-Gore campaign that made the most use of it. But when that webpage did launch, by that point, I wasn't asking permission. I did a memo with a screenshot
and
sent it up the line and said, here's a picture of your webpage. You know, congrats, you're the first.
If I remember correctly, this work that you did kind of culminated in a book that you wrote called The Hill on the Net, right?
That's correct.
And what year did that come out?
It was published in 96, so still kind of even
kind of
early.
Probably were writing it in 95.
I had played around enough with the notion of writing something that I had scribbled a few yellow notebook paper pages. And at the time, just as the senator was getting press for his efforts online, I was frequently speaking at conferences here and there. And I had spoken at the Internet World Conference in San Jose. I don't know if you remember Internet World Magazine, and they did an annual conference. So I talked about what we were doing to bring a senator online. And when I returned to D.C. shortly after, I had a letter from a publisher who had seen me speak, soliciting a book. He said, we saw you speak. That's pretty interesting. And I know, I mean, that's not how it happens. People write books and work very hard to find someone interested. So to have it
but you were
fall
on the cutting
in my
edge.
Lap like that. So yeah, I made sure I was okay again within my role on the Hill. It actually happened right at the time I was transitioning from Kennedy's office, because with the 94 elections, sadly, we lost the majority. It was the good news, bad news. Kennedy won. And, you know, hung on to his seat. You remember his challenger?
Romney.
Yeah. And we had put his campaign online.
I did some calling in that race.
Did you?
Yeah.
In fact, in some tiny little way during the campaign.
For a while, it looked like Romney would be a serious challenger. And then they ramped up the campaign and the natural blue of Massachusetts came
definitely,
through.
Definitely. Yeah. There's some, you know, stories about Romney family labor issues back in Michigan
didn't play well for Romney at that point.
In that case, in that campaign sense, the DSCC was putting up kind of templated campaign sites for every one of their Democratic candidates. Right. But knowing that Kennedy had a webpage, in our case, they said, we got the web space if you want to do it. And so, sure. I took my a Kennedy bumper sticker around the corner to Alpha Graphics to get the benefit of a scanner so I could digitize the bumper
sticker.
Can't
take a picture with your phone yet.
I know. For a while there, while I was up in Boston, Eric Loeb and I would physically take a computer and a long phone line to different newspapers, and we'd have to, you know, unplug their fax machine so we could plug in and dial up and show them a campaign website. And I guess I'm probably proudest of my innovative use of Netscape's new blink tag for the get out to vote message on the at the end.
So things have changed, Will. What was the reception for that book like? Was there any marketing of it? How did
it was. I write best under pressure of a deadline. And so once I had a book arrangement and had a commitment to deliver a manuscript by whatever it was, I think January of 96, it was like, okay. Because I had two very small children, a third on the way, and of course my still full-time day job in the Senate. So I was working on this in the evenings and writing it. But it was very much anecdotal, telling tales of different stories about Congress's efforts to get online and some of the challenges.
Do you remember any in particular?
Oh, sure. I mean, I have benefited always from collaboration and working with people a lot smarter than myself.
We all have.
and initially, like with Eric and John, yourself included, Laura Quinn. But my Senate collaborator was a guy named Jeff Hecker. And Jeff had worked for Senator Mitchell and hence to the Democratic
leadership. Former Senate Majority Leader of the Senate.
Yep. From Maine, exactly. Mm-hmm. Jeff was, he would describe himself as a nerd. He's almost a decade older than me. Huge fan of Dilbert, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and The Who. And
interesting combination.
But also, on a technical level, one of the smartest guys I ever knew. To the extent that, more so than the Senate Computer Center or what we were being offered as services. So Jeff collaborated with me quite a bit in pushing people towards action. There was surprising hesitance to give Senate staff access to the internet. I've never really understood why, but in the Senate, I guess it's just the notion of things are slow to change. And in fact, when internet access was originally granted to an office, it was to three IP addresses. The office basically had to pick the three computers in the office who could have access to the internet. I think it was a misguided notion of control, yeah. Like the uncertainty about what it would mean for ubiquitous internet access to every intern in a Senate office was just not welcome ground for a cautious institution. So what happened, though, was Jeff really quickly started a small business, strictly volunteer, of taking obsolete old compact 286 computers and basically turning them into routers for any office that would want one. Make that machine one of the three blessed IPs that could give access to the internet, and then connecting everybody in the office to that
clever
machine.
Yeah.
So we were staying within the rules as they were laid out, but maybe not in the spirit as intended, which gave it the extra benefit of course, it masked the individual desktop user. It was that machine that was online as far as Senate logs were concerned.
That's cool. So what came next for you after the Senate? How did you leave and what came next?
After the 94 cycle, when we lost the majority and Daschle became the new leader, he created a new leadership committee called the Technology and Communications Committee. And in that, he was bringing together existing services like each party committee has a television and radio studio, chart-making services for floor charts. And now we were adding this new component, this internet. But bringing all of these various communication channels under one committee. And so Jeff and I were the two internet guys helping offices do everything. I mean, building their websites, helping them arrange online chats. We did a lot of like AOL chats and stuff. We would be kind of like a technology test bed. I remember our first, digital camera, our Apple QuickTake camera. And so if an office wanted to borrow the camera to take digital photos of their event to put on their website, we were the place that could help them do that. And so I spent the first 3 years in the Senate with Kennedy, but five more years then basically being a internet cheerleader to the whole Democratic caucus.
And through what year?
Through 2000.
And I remember because I had started NGP software in January 97, and around 98, I was talking to some folks at a company called Net Capital.
Okay.
That was doing some other politics and internet stuff. And they were like, you should know this Chris Casey guy. That was the first time I'd heard of you.
You know, that it's funny you mentioned that, because that's a whole big story I would have overlooked myself. And it was a website called CapWeb. Because something I realized early on, too. So Kennedy got online, I think on the House side, it was Peter DeFazio from Oregon was the first House member to have a website. The Library of Congress, pre-Thomas, had a Library of Congress site shortly thereafter. But there was no single unifying congressional website. And I had seen a terrific Canadian site that was that. I mean, if you think about what would be the web-based version of the little CQ pocket guide to Congress that every lobbyist carries around in their briefcase or person,
you know. This is way before Wikipedia and things like that.
Exactly. And the epiphany I had there was anybody can build it. It doesn't have to be an official guide to Congress. Anybody with the wherewithal to take it on. And that was just the kind of thing that would get Jeff's gears turned into. And he's like, yeah, I'm in. So we built CapWeb. We built a website, a web-based directory of Congress. It ultimately linked down to basic information about every member, but we had a great focus on if they had any online resource, an email address, a Gopher directory, or a newfangled website, we linked to it. So we created this unofficial square one for finding Congress online, and Net Capital provided an initial home for it. So that's how I came to know them. And there was the free version of CapWeb. They turned it into a business because at the same time, trade associations who on their own sites wanted to likewise, you know, share a branded version of a congressional directory had their little CapWeb customs.
What was it about 2000 that led you away from this work?
It was the opportunities to jump all the way over to the campaign side. Now, like a lot of congressional staffers, like I said, I had worked on Kennedy's 94 campaign to bring him online. Another colleague of mine named Jeremy Doran, we both hit our entrepreneurial moment there and decided there was a business to be found in building campaign websites. And so in 2000 was when Kennedy was up again, and so we did his next Senate campaign. But we also did Hillary Clinton's first Senate race, and we had Chuck Robb, and ended up with a nice array of clients, of little handmade websites.
So you are really a pioneer in the campaign website space there for Senate campaigns, and I think some others as well, right? Other statewides.
Definitely. Yeah. And it was...
And this Doran Casey? Was that the
Casey,
name?
Casey Doran, Casey Doran Internet Doran. Productions.
Yeah.
Campaigns were excited. Then again, there was still this kind of early buzz about whether there's something going to be there. This was before...
Did any of these have online fundraising yet?
I think that was the cycle where... Wasn't it in 2000 that Bill Bradley was the first presidential to raise more than $1 million online? And then John McCain in short order did like $6 million.
To what Sanders raised in a short number of hours lately.
No question that was the tipping point for candidates to be like, hey, I need to take a second look at this internet thing.
This is not just a brochure.
It was an exciting time because campaigns were willing to be more experimental and do things that maybe a congressional office would be more slow to do, you know, more cautious about. And so the opportunity to innovate was more apparent on the campaign side of the fence than on the official side.
It's not an easy place to start a business in political campaigns and technology. What did you learn from trying to run an enterprise in that space?
Oh, I learned so much. I learned about receivables, I think I learned.
Getting paid?
I learned about just because you're working for the good guys doesn't mean they're always on time with their obligations.
Yeah.
I learned about getting through a design and development process with many cooks and family members and all kinds of other expertise that's got an opinion to offer.
Did you have contractors or other employees at any point?
Yeah, and that was another lesson I learned too, was I would at the time hire freelancers myself, you know, to expand as needed to do design and coding of a website. But there were times, I guess I wasn't the smartest businessman, where I'm paying a freelancer by the hour on a website I sold for a flat rate.
You're losing money.
Yeah, there were times like, wait a minute, this isn't adding up here for me.
It's so extremely hard to run a services firm, I think.
Well, and 2 years into it, Jeremy decided his path went through law school. And so I went from having a partner to being a one-man band. And I think that ultimately leads to our formal introduction story. It was the Landry 2002 campaign.
So I had provided them campaign software.
Right.
Yeah.
And I was aware of, and probably, well, I'm not sure now if I had ever built a site that connected to you, but to their great credit, their campaign manager brought you and I together in a meeting in a hotel lobby, and we're like, okay, campaign software database guy and website guy, play nice. I mean, they didn't have any specifics. They just wanted us to know each other. And I think our first exchange was probably like, can your database import a CSV file? I was like, yeah, I think we can do that. And we were like, but do you remember what happened?
I do not.
If you subscribed or volunteered via the website, it was just captured in a text file, a CSV file that I would once a week.
So we would import into our software.
I was emailing that file off to the campaign for them to import
into
your software. And when I followed up and said, how's that going? Just doing a little spot check on is everything clean? They said, it's going great. We're taking the list of names you sent us. We print them out and our interns key them into NGP.
Oh, no. So, I do remember that now.
I called you.
That's not exactly the using the machine to its best.
It wasn't optimal, no, but they were getting it done.
Did we get that fixed?
I don't recall, you know, and I think it's sometimes the case where there's an efficient way of doing things and there's a, but I've got a room full of interns who have something to need to do way.
We're long since having those integrations together. So a number of years later, I was able to talk you into joining us at NGP Software. What was happening with you then, and why did you make such a foolish move?
It was a wonderful move. It was one cycle later. It was at the end of the 2004 cycle. And I had an array of campaigns that I'd worked with, but I also did a lot of work with the DNC in that cycle as well. And most of my time at the DNC leading up to the finish, and they were doing, you know, house parties on their website and stuff like that by then. But come the Wednesday after Election Day, win or lose for Kerry, I was pretty much out of business in the ups and downs of you know, signing up the next campaign. And originally, yeah, you and I got together and talked about jointly pitching some campaigns, because people who were coming to you for your software, you had learned, were very frequently saying, can you do a website for me? What else can you do for me? And when you made the offer to be like, what if instead of us just pitching them together, you come to work and build a team? I was like, so I get to build a team and you're going to pay them the salary? And you're like, yeah. I was like, yeah, that sounds good. Let's do that.
So together we built a little bit of a practice in building websites within NGP, which goes on to today.
I think that tally, I looked it up, was hundreds, you know, in my 7 years there. And we built a terrific team, at least 260
websites
over those 7 years, probably more, and did a lot of exciting stuff. But again, at that time too, over those 7 years, we kind of saw a campaign website go from a handmade, crafted thing to a more commoditized
assembly line turnkey type
of thing.
Yeah.
And so I can't deny that I never lost any of my passion for Democratic politics, but it did start becoming a bit of
a little repetition,
you know, candidates saying, like, make the website whatever colors you want as long as it's red, white, and blue, and make it like Obama's. And it's like, yeah, sure, you want the red, white, and blue Obama order. Got it. We can do that.
What else do you remember from your 7+ years at NGP Software?
Well, again, really, that was a wonderful opportunity for me in that to a greater degree than I'd had before of being able to build and manage a team. As a dabbler, I could play around with Photoshop and create a passable website banner, you know, in 2000 or 2002, but reaching the peak of my skills pretty quick. And I could cobble together a functional website using movable type or something like that. But higher end coding skills weren't my realm either. And so it was time for me to graduate into those who can't do, teach, or manage. And so the team we initially built, Peter and Sean and so many that followed, Paul and Tuvin, designers and coders who will always have much greater skills than me, but the opportunity to bring to them a decades of experience working in the space and some hard lessons learned. So broadly, those are my greatest memories, was having that team.
What was next for you?
Well, so in 2011, I had another terrific opportunity, and I joined a nonprofit group called NetCentric Campaigns, which operated very much like a digital agency, except that they were themselves a nonprofit, and they typically received foundation grants from foundations looking for digital help for their other grantees.
Who ran that?
Marty Kearns ran it, and they had been several years old. It was Paul who had previously worked there for a short time and pointed me in, and Paul Kittredge had. They had their biggest project at the time was a network called PreventObesity.net, which brought together leaders across the country who had the common fight against childhood obesity. But while I was there, I built a network in Maryland called the Moving Maryland Forward Network, which connected a bunch of multi-issue progressive advocates in the state of Maryland. Or I built a national network called the Halt the Harm Network, connecting people who are united in the fight against fracking. It was a nice change for me because after doing the campaign and candidate work for so long, it was eye-opening to me to now work with deep-pocketed foundations who weren't so focused on just election day and everything comes to a stop then, that are ready to take on issues that they're going to fight for the long term, and they're going to be fighting childhood obesity for 15 years or fighting fracking for 30 years. And it really introduced me to, I still enjoyed the comfort of working for the good guys, but at a different kind of pace. And it really broadened my experience and liked it quite a bit.
What was next?
What was next was, when you're working in a nonprofit, grants come and grants go. I found myself in an employment lull. I filled a gap a couple different interesting. You remember Matt McMillan for Buzzmaker.
Yep.
I did a 40-day gig with him in 2015 as digital director for the Unity Labor Party in St. Vincent and the Grenadines.
He has definitely a practice all over the Central and South America.
He really does. And yeah. It was quite an experience. I mean, I loved the shortness of the campaign, 40 days, boom. Yeah. You know, I mean, of course, a 40-day work gig in the Caribbean is not the worst thing that could happen.
Were you able to get outside?
Yeah, yeah. A bit. And the entire country was geographically twice the size of D.C. Demographically, it was Green Bay, Wisconsin, a 15-seat, you know, legislature, and 40 days from announcement to election day.
Sounds like a pretty interesting experience.
Well, I mean, I find myself at the keyboard sitting next to the Prime Minister, Ralph Gonsalves, you know, typing his responses to Facebook questions. And I'm really, yeah, I'm flashing into my talking heads, you know, how did I get here? But it was terrific.
That's awesome.
But that can last forever. I spent a bit of time working for a well-regarded progressive phone firm, Winning Connections.
Were they trying to get into the website space?
Exactly. Yeah. Not the website so much, but just digital. I mean, because they were advertising for a vice president for digital. And I recall in my interview, I said to them, you know, I really know nothing about phones. I've never done a phone campaign. I don't know what you do. And to their credit, they were like, well, we kind of got the phone part handled. You know, we want to know how we amplify what we're doing on phones with digital.
Was that successful? Did you think you built a practice there for them? Or?
It's probably still TBD.
It seems to be very hard for companies to change their DNA. You know, it certainly took us a long time to get into the website business in a really successful way.
Yeah.
It's a big challenge to add a practice.
Well, and I think it's an oft-repeated story now among consultants. It's like, okay, we're a direct mail firm, but we need to be able to say we do digital too. We're a phone firm, right. And here's what we do on digital. And then, right. Well, we're a digital agency. Right. And so...
All the people doing television yeah. commercials, not all of them have migrated to a digital first mode. A lot of them keep doing what they're doing and release it in a different way.
Exactly.
It's just hard.
Exactly. And digital has become so encompassing a term now. It's maybe losing some of it. I mean, like you said, does that mean you build websites? Does that mean you place ads?
Everything
does
is digital mean, now,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. It might have been one of your previous guests, I recall, saying, you know, she advises firms, you know, don't call your team a digital team. They should be ubiquitous throughout. It's not a separate team. It's a way of working for every department of your campaign.
Right. The more people can integrate the marketing and the practice of collaboration and communication, the better.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We did do some interesting things because, of course, like on phones, you know, you're trying to make phones ring in a congressional office with a patch call. Someone in your target audience at home gets a phone call and gets a quick, you know, here's the background brief, or do you want to talk to your member about that issue? We'll connect you now. And how can you either complement that or expand on that with targeted digital ads?
So, Chris, what's your current work?
My current work was a little over a year ago, I joined a DC-based software startup called TuSomeone. And as it turned out, TuSomeone was founded by a guy named Trevor Davis, who was himself a digital guide, a nonprofit firm, and who built his own tools to meet his own needs. He built a pretty typical, you know, petition tool. And again, that brings us back to petitions. But we've reached a point where petition means less about, like, I'm gathering reams of paper to drop on someone's doorstep as a display of public support or outrage, as much as it's also quite straightforward list building. Petitions are for building your email list.
And that's like change.org came out of that model, right?
Now, I'm not saying any online petitions don't necessarily have a delivery moment or aren't sent to a decision maker.
Yeah, I whenever I see these petitions now, I wonder, beyond list building, what is the purpose of my signing them?
Yeah. And so sometimes it might be with a tool like NGP Every Action, where that's part of the transaction. You know, it identifies your members and it sends an email. In other cases, they can be very vague. I mean, with no identified target, and it's, I'm with her. I pledge to support this, you know, and no necessary clear target.
A petition to impeach the president, which seems to be a list building opportunity for a billionaire or something like
well,
that.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of your listeners, maybe not, would recall the history of Move On, right? I mean, Move On is a major, major force in progressive advocacy, and they were born of a petition during the Clinton impeachment. Right. And the original full name was Censure and Move On.
Right.
And they gathered about 500,000 signatures.
Which became one of the biggest lists, if not the biggest list around in politics.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, then they found the impeachment pressed on. They weren't successful in starting it. You know, so they took the power of that list and started their next campaign called We Will Remember, and emailed, you know, those supporters specifically to target the reelection campaigns of the impeachment managers.
The amazing example of the power of the pivot in kind of an entrepreneurial way to take an initial concept and continue to adapt with the times and grow and become more and more important.
It just demonstrates the case of when you've gone to the trouble of building a list, its value continues.
If you, you know, continue if, to if, renew if it and give the people on exactly. that list a reason to exactly. keep doing things.
And I mean, now that's a routine metric we use to gauge the strength of a campaign or a candidate, right? The Bernie's list or Beto's list or, yep. you know, their ability to reach into people's inboxes.
So what I'm not clear on is what does To Someone do?
So To Someone built a tool called Good Action.
Good Action?
Good Action. And Good Action is a petition tool. Mm-hmm. But what's unique about Good Action is it is integrates with other platforms to gather additional data from other sources, ultimately providing really rich reports that can tell you more about the supporters you gain.
I don't understand the name. What's the name mean?
It's a call to action, right? Mm-hmm. A petition is sometimes in our industry called a call to action. You write a good call to action, and this is about writing good calls to action.
Oh, I was thinking about the To Someone, the... So
I think that's focused more originally
with a pipe in between.
Yeah. Oh, you're going to have to ask Trevor that one. I remember when I first saw the logo, I was like, well, tell me about the parrot. And he was like, it's a puffin. I was like, well, of course it is.
That's a nice looking logo. I like it.
It is. I had actually met Trevor once before. I had learned after remaking his acquaintance that I had seen him do one of the speed product demos at Netroots Nation in St. Louis a year earlier. And so seeing someone, it's a unique combination. The advocate with developer skills who's building the tools they want because they're unhappy with what's out
and
there.
And in fact, that's often... That's a great route to building software in the space is somebody who's been in the space who found a gap. I think of Phone to Action, another company that's doing extraordinarily well. The Heman of the founder, you know, she wanted tools that weren't there and went out and built them and built a company around it.
Exactly.
It's a similar thing.
And that was the case with Trevor. So what Good Action does is we're not a CRM. We're a product that complements a client's other existing digital tools. Mm-hmm. And two of the ways it does that is on the front end by integrating with your social ads so that at the moment you create a petition, you can likewise, using the same content, the same text and imagery you just put into building the petition and push an ad straight out to Facebook or whatever. So it's a time saver.
What sort of clients do you guys have?
Our target client is an agency that is serving multiple clients. Mm-hmm. So typically we're not chasing the individual campaign or the nonprofit.
What agencies do you work with?
A couple of our early clients are SB Digital is one and Rising Tide Interactive is another. Mm-hmm. And clients who they in turn could use the benefit of a platform like this that both allows them to support their multiple clients. But ultimately, the other benefit that really has strong appeal to an agency like that is, in addition to the integration with the CRM, we're integrating with the payment platform with ActBlue and with CRMs initially, NGP, EveryAction, and BSD. So we can pull together a really rich report that a lot of agencies right now put together a lot of staff hours cobbling together.
How many years now would you say you've been in this intersection between politics and technology? So that's since... 90.
Well, I joined Kennedy's office in 92.
Right. And so now that you have a chance to think a little bit about the trajectory and the history, where do you think we are right now?
Well, it's funny you ask that. I've spent an awful lot of time on you. I imagine you too. I mean, coming back to my book, in 2016, when I was in a lull, my wife suggested, write. You know, you haven't written in a while. And a couple things occurred to me. My book had come out, it was 20 years old. My book had come out in 96. In 96, there was no Kindle. There was no iBook. So there's no digital version of my book that exists. And once my book went out of print, the copyright reverted to me. So I own it. So I had the notion not of writing a new edition, but to take the original text and just all throughout it, put little sidebars in. The book came out in 96, and from 96 and the remainder of my time in the Senate, I maintained a newsletter because the story was ongoing. If the hardest part about finishing the original version of the book was finding a stopping point because every single day there was something new to include. And so for 4 years, I maintained a listserv, an email list that went out to subscribers, and continued telling stories. The Senate got hacked. The Senate has reached 100 senators on the web. Anecdotal stories about Congress on the internet. So that was another notion. I would take all of those and package them and add them to this ebook. Now, of course, the challenges are the same. First of all, I left the Senate in 2000, so I've been gone, you know, much longer than I was there. There was no social media at the time. That's a whole nother book. I can't catch up everything that happened. So I'm still in progress. And the original notion that I would finish it quickly and call it the 20th anniversary ebook edition, you know, is way in the rear view.
Is 25 still possible?
Yeah, oh yeah. I hope so.
You are one indication that you've been around with the internet since the beginning is that you have Casey.com,
yeah. Right?
Which is probably impossible to procure something like that nowadays. Maybe Perlman.com, I don't know. Do you get people coming after you for that domain?
Frequently. Yeah. I mean, a couple times a month, I'll get an email offer saying, would you be willing to part with it? And depending on how snarky I'm feeling, I'll either say, I understand the interest, but no, it's not for sale. Or I'll follow up and say, well, everything's for sale. You know,
Talk to me about six digits.
Are we talking about a life of leisure? But I try and be understanding because I was that guy. That's how I got it. The domain was registered by a woman named Kathleen Creighton, her initials KC. She was an early user of The Well, a famous San Francisco-based dial-up bulletin board system. She was herself a reviewer who wrote like in Computer World magazine about bulletin board reviews and stuff. But there was nothing on the web at Casey.com. And I had emailed her on a number of occasions and said, you don't seem to be using it. Would you be willing to part with it? Finally, I emailed the technical contact instead of her, the owner, and the response I got was, Kathleen has passed away, and it's all yours,
wow.
And just transferred it to me.
Wow.
And I recently wrote a blog post telling that story, and I hope to be a good steward of Casey.com for the time that I've got it.
Well, hopefully someone will have to wait a long time to acquire it a similar way.
I've trained my children with all the access they need to my domain registration. One of my best moments was my son got married last year, so I got to give my new daughter-in-law her Casey.com email address.
That's lovely. Is there a question I should have asked that I failed to?
Well, we started a little bit on the, you know, how do you feel about where it's come.
Yeah, that's true. We didn't really finish
that. Because with everything that's happened, especially in this most recent presidential cycle and stuff, it's hard not to reflect and be like, is this where it's all led to? I mean, looking back,
this all led to Trump.
I know. And I think there's very serious reasons for concern about how far corrupted we are from what were my very early idealistic notions of what the internet was going to mean for politics. The instant access to information, a better informed citizenry, there was nothing but upsides to what the internet would mean to politics.
I think that was kind of a naive and lovely thing that a lot of the internet pioneers sort of shared, that this was going to transform the world for the better. And it has been an amazing, great development for mankind in sharing good information. But unfortunately, it's brought the bad side in along with it.
Well, and I'm fascinated by the fact that there was the inventor of the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee. This year, as a matter of fact, next month will mark 30 years since his original paper where he described...
Which is a long time and an incredibly short time.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And he, a year ago, wrote this open letter to the internet about, you know, his concerns about what was happening. He threw out three particular challenges. And one was, we've lost control of our personal data. It's too easy for misinformation to spread on the web. And that political advertising needs more transparency and understanding. That those key things that he's concerned about are things that are just right in our space. Because you just said it, it's We naively assumed only good information.
And that's like for those people who kind of lean against government regulation, what we've learned over time is if you don't regulate in a smart way different human endeavors, that problems creep in. That's why we have, you know, regulation of the food supply in 1906 or whatever, because you get businesses that don't necessarily do upstanding things with, you know, taking care of the hogs or something like that. And we may well need to regulate some of these big internet monopolies or near monopolies. We may need to, you know, figure out ways to make political advertising accountable to some version of truth. And it's just, you can't just be hands off necessarily when you see the consequences of free for all.
Well, and ultimately, it's not the technology. It's the people. We're the weak link. It doesn't care what information it transfers. It's just data. So I think the bigger challenge is, as citizens, are we doing an effective job identifying good information, questioning bad information, being skeptical? And I read something recently that's maybe a little bit cause for concern. It was, the assumption that, so here you and I will be members of the last generation that remembers life before the internet, right? So we can be, it's like, oh yeah, you know, I remember when I didn't have an email address. And the assumption naturally follows that younger people, digital natives, are more savvy just because they're born into this, reality. I read in the book, Smarter Than You Think, a study of 102 Northwestern University undergraduates found that none ever bothered to check an author's credential on a website. And another found that more than a third of college students were unaware that search engines include paid-for links in the result.
Yeah. The problem is it all comes back to education, right? Mm-hmm. And it comes back to some personal responsibility for what you post, what you do online, how you treat other people, and how you examine the information that comes to you.
And in this letter that Tim Berners-Lee had written, he wrote, it's taken all of us to build the web that we have, and now it's up to all of us to build the web we want. I'm definitely cynical. I've over a career, I think, as natural with anybody as they age.
The idealism has ebbed a tiny bit.
It's a little bit tarnished, but it's not dashed. At the end of the day, it's on everybody individually to be smarter themselves.
And on groups and government to help us along towards the right result, I guess.
Yeah.
Chris, it's been wonderful to have a chance to catch up with you today.
I'd like to add one more thing, if I could. Yeah. For any of your listeners who made it this far to the end, one thing I've done to help motivate my own productivity finishing this electronic update is to offer free copies. So if anybody's made it this far,
it's going to be down to one person.
And take yourself to casey.com/ebook and fill out the form, and I will send you a digital version of my book when that happens.
Yes, he's doing his list building right
there.
Here.
You go, right? You got me.
Well, thank you, Chris.
Thank you, so Nathaniel. Much. It's been a pleasure.
That was Chris Casey. He is at tosomeone.com. I'm glad Chris is still out there providing advice and consult to our side. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with the Great Battlefield Podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.